Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay.
And me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can't fully understand the moment we're living in without knowing where we've been. On every episode of NPR's Throughline, we take a story from the news and go back in time to where it started, where it really started. To answer one important question, how did we get here? Find NPR's Throughline on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Molly Jongfast, and this is Fast Politics, where we discuss the top political headlines with some of today's best minds. And Sarah Huckabee Sanders has rolled back big portions of her state's child labor protections. We have a great show today. NPR's David Folkenflik stops by to talk to us about the latest leaks in the Fox News Dominion lawsuit. Then we'll talk to former Senator Doug Jones about how Dems can regain ground in the South. But first, we have the host of the Lawrence O'Donnell Show, MSNBC's Lawrence O'Donnell. Welcome back to Fast Politics, Lawrence O'Donnell.
Oh, great to be back with my new microphone that I'm so proud of that I bought just for this conversation.
Yes, we love that. Very excited. I want to talk to you first about the Dominion filing, because this is not your first rodeo and you have been in this business, the business of politics and then the business of media. I think a lot of us suspected that this was happening, but were you just shocked that there were like actual text messages documenting these things?
No, I would have been shocked if there was a shred of evidence of a shred of decency there, including in the, you know, Brett Baier department, which has always been corrupt. But, you know, the news media has never wanted to believe that there's this imposter. It's not a cancer on the business. It's just an imposter. You know, it's like the wrestling channel said, called itself Wrestling News. And the news media just, oh, well, it's news. It's been a fraud from the first day. I remember before they opened their doors, I remember walking down Sixth Avenue and hearing from someone that, oh, you know, Rupert Murdoch's going to start a Republican TV channel. I, because I'm brilliant about these things, said, well, no one's going to watch that. And, you know, because Republican TV channel to me sounded like more boring than C-SPAN at the time, because the Republican Party was Bob Dole and, you know, that stuff. But, you know, here we are. It's always been what it is. And it just horrifies me that people keep using the word that Rupert Murdoch ordered them to use when he filled out the corporate papers titling the business Fox News. That is a classic case of what the senator I worked for, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, would call semantic infiltration. And that is infiltrating your language to force you to say what I want you to say. And so there are these attempts to do that in politics in various ways with phrases like pro-life. I'm going to call myself pro-life, therefore you have to. And the news business obeys those commands. But I mean, I have not put the word news after the word Fox in many, many, many years because it's just a lie. And the whole thing is a fraud. And everybody working there, there's not a single person working there who's in the news business. There never has been.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's right. And I just want to get back to what you said about Bret Baier, because they had this distinction that there was a news side and an entertainment side. But what's very clear from this is that's not true.
Yeah, no, Bret Baier was horrified that Fox called Arizona first, and he was horrified that they lost viewers because of it. That's never happened in any of the real news divisions around there. I can confess to you, this may come as a shock if I pull back the curtain a little bit, but I personally, I won't speak for others at MSNBC, but I personally was deeply disappointed when we realized Donald Trump was going to win the Electoral College. And I realized it about a half an hour before other people, because I was sitting there with Steve Schmidt and James Carville. We had our own little studio and we would do our own little cut-ins. And for 20 minutes at a time, we were not on TV. And those two guys were doing way more than the decision desk does. They were texting and calling people they know in such and such a county in North Carolina. And I would hear James Carville talking to someone in, you know, North Carolina and say, well, if we lose that, then we're going to lose Wisconsin. And all he's getting is a report from one particular district in North Carolina that he knows mirrors Wisconsin and all that. So I kind of knew the tragedy unfolding about a half an hour before everybody else. And there wasn't a moment where it crossed my mind, well, we can't, as a network, go out there and say Donald Trump won. We can't do that. You know, it's like, no, sorry, never crossed my mind.
I think that's a really good point, is that they tried to shape the news to fit the narrative. But I'm curious, it seems like the larger problem that Fox ends up having, and you see in these filings, is that they have given their listeners, their viewers, so much of what they want that they have sort of been unable to shape reality to what these people needed to hear. And so there is this sort of almost, I mean, I feel like it's like something from a sci-fi novel where they realize that they can no longer shape reality to meet the demand.
They are continuing to deliver exactly what they believe that audience wants. Here's the funny thing about it. You know, when they talk about, oh, we watched our ratings collapse that week. Yeah. It was a rough week for Fox, but here's the way it goes, and everybody knows this, and everyone knew this ahead of time. And it would have been true in 2004, you know, with George W. Bush, and it was true in 2008, you know, when Obama won. So if the Republican wins the presidency, the MSNBC ratings are going to drop because there's going to be a depression in a majority of that audience, okay? Then they don't want to consume this stuff anymore. And if the Democrats win the presidency, there was always a drop, always, every time, a drop in the Fox ratings that week, okay?
Right.
And it didn't mean Fox wasn't going to make billions of dollars. It meant there was this kind of moment, you know, the Super Bowl is over and the fans are not watching football the next week. That's just the way it works. And so their panic about losing audience is just so despicable on every level, including the money level, because they were all going to remain very, very rich. Fox was going to continue to make billions, and they are panicking over this relatively slight and totally predictable and temporary drop in ratings.
It's so interesting, though, because they sort of can't ride with it. But I also do think it ended up being what I think is pretty interesting, is that they ended up this choice they made, which they clearly made a choice. They knew what they were doing. It's clear they knew that the 2020 election was free and fair. They did it because they just didn't have a hold on the market.
They did it because they thought it was their job. It's a Republican Party operation. And the doctrine of the Republican Party in the 21st century, and this was not always the case, but by the 21st century, what it became, Republicanism simply became, we hate liberals.
Right.
It's nothing else. There's no policy. There's no balance the budget. There's no eliminate the deficit. There's no policy at all, except tax cuts and we hate liberals. And we get our tax cuts by convincing people who are not rich, who also hate liberals, to vote for us. And that's the entire scheme. And that's Murdoch's entire scheme. He has no other objective except, you know, the demonization of liberals. And so that's the game. So they're going to do that, and they're going to do whatever is necessary to do that. And there are absolutely no limits. And I promise you, there have never been limits. There's never been a day at Fox, never a day where they had any kind of moral or ethical limit on what they might do or say.
Yeah.
And all you're seeing, if you see a difference between Sean Hannity 1997 and Sean Hannity 2017, and there is, it is simply what is acceptable. What are the bounds of acceptability? And so those things change in every sphere of life, you know, over time, over a 20-year period, you know, what's acceptable to say contracts and expands in different kinds of ways. And so they're just playing within the zone that is now acceptable. And what's acceptable now in Republicanism is literally anything it takes, anything to beat and destroy liberals.
So one of the things that I've been continually having a argument with, even very smart Republicans, but tend to be Republicans, is this idea that DeSantis is somehow less dangerous than Trump. Can you just debunk this? I mean, this just blows my mind, this idea that somehow someone who is much better at doing this is less dangerous than Trump.
Yeah, I don't think there's any real evidence for that case that DeSantis is less dangerous than Trump. I always, when I was watching Trump, I was always thanking the luck of the draw every day, just how lucky we are that he's an imbecile. We are so lucky that he is as deeply, profoundly, and permanently stupid as he is. Because if he was just a couple of notches smarter, you know, the things that he was trying to do could be done with better premeditation. Like, even, for example, I'm going to need an attorney general when re-election comes who's going to do anything for me in the Justice Department. He had, because he's stupid, reason to believe that Barr was that guy. And Barr was disgraceful, and Barr disgraced himself beyond what anyone who knew him could have imagined. But still, there were going to be limits, you know, for somebody who grew up in the law like Bill Barr. And Trump found those limits in November, you know, of 2020. If he had planned a year ahead of time, who is the idiot, the hack, the moron I want as attorney general for that moment? He could have basically told Bill Barr to quit, right? Because you don't have to get this guy confirmed. You don't have to get him confirmed. You, as we saw with the crazy, you know, lawyer from the Justice Department, who he temporarily for a few hours made acting attorney general. He could have gotten a guy like that in a smoother way. And DeSantis would get that guy in a smoother way. He would have premeditated it. Trump is this imbecile who is late with his homework every single time, right? Yeah. And so
no, exactly.
And we're lucky, you know, we're very lucky because of that. DeSantis is the most premeditated of his kind I've ever seen. Like he's way beyond Trump in all of that.
Yeah, that's what I think, too. I mean, the book banning, the education stuff. I mean,
let me just add one difference to DeSantis that could be a civilizing factor, because Donald Trump did something that has never been done before in the history of the presidency. Every single person except Franklin Roosevelt in our recent time who won the presidency immediately tried to figure out, how do I get the voters who didn't vote for me? And the reason I say except Franklin Roosevelt is because his first election was a landslide and his second election was even bigger, right? And so, but everybody else is, you know, kind of squeaking in there. You know, JFK won the presidency by less than 1% of the vote. 8 years later, Richard Nixon wins the presidency by less than 1% of the vote. Both of them wanted to sound appealing to people who didn't vote for them. Everybody has done that. Ronald Reagan did that. Ronald Reagan won 49 states in the Electoral College in his reelection because after he got elected and after he built a career as a right winger, the most extreme right winger in the party, every day of his presidency, he was trying to appeal to what came to be called the Reagan Democrat. Trump gets elected. He does it. And all I did, I'm telling you, when he was elected, all I did was sit there and listen for what did he say today to the people who didn't vote for him. And there literally was not a sentence, not one day of the entire time. And that is why he didn't get reelected. If you wanted to get it to its most simplest point, that's why he didn't get reelected. The guy who came in second in the vote, but got the Electoral College anyway, that guy didn't try to convert any voters, guess what's going to happen to him next time? He's going to come in second again. And so DeSantis, I suspect may, if he were to win the White House, he might spend 4 years trying to appeal to people who didn't vote for him and go from 48% of the vote up to 51% of the vote.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point. I also think,
and by the way, and the way a Republican appeals to people who didn't vote for him is obviously not with Republican ideas. It is to soften the edges of Republican notions. You know, it's the compassionate conservative stuff that the Bushes would talk about.
Right. Well, and I also think it's sort of faking it, right?
It depends. I mean, you know, George H.W. Bush wasn't faking it in the sense that he did reach legislative compromises with Democrats in Congress, and that some of which were significant, you know, and he was condemned for it by Republicans, by Pat Buchanan, you know, by the lunatics. George W. Bush was very much concerned with what you thought of him, very much. And he was very much concerned about that, even if you didn't vote for him. And that is a civilizing influence on politicians. Trump has none of it. And in Florida, DeSantis has none of it. We'll see what would happen if he goes national.
I want to just drill down on this for a minute. Don't you get the sense that DeSantis, he lost a debate to Charlie Crist? I mean, don't you think there's a lot riding on someone who no one has ever really seen?
No, I actually think he's had a great deal of exposure for a presidential candidate, you know, way more than Jimmy Carter had as a governor. I mean, when Jimmy Carter announced that he was running for president, everybody outside of Georgia said, who? No one knew that name. Same thing with Bill Clinton. People didn't know who that guy was. DeSantis's visibility as a governor is as high as I've ever seen for a governor who was not already a presidential candidate. You know, Michael Dukakis, nobody knew how to say that word outside of Massachusetts, you know, when he announced as a governor. And so he's gotten a tremendous amount of visibility. And, you know, we're at the stage where debates have declined dramatically in how much they matter. If they mattered, Donald Trump, you know, would have gotten 20% of the vote. That's an old notion that we all used to have about how is this, you know, candidate going to stand up in the debates, you know, in presidential debates. And it's like, well, doesn't matter very much. The biggest clown in the history of presidential debating, you know, won the Republican nomination in 2016 and then, you know, went on from there.
Yeah, it seemed to make no difference. Do you think that Biden, this is an anxiety I have, that taking New Hampshire out of the lineup is going to hurt him in the general election?
Not in the least. That's just a, you know, it's a fetishistic thing that not a single voter in a single state cares about. You have to remember that most voters in America do not get a chance ever to participate in a presidential primary that has any impact whatsoever on the presidential election. That's the truth for most American voters. And their spirit as voters is not affected by it. I mean, I want someone to find me the voter in New Hampshire, you know, in November, who says, yeah, I mean, I was gonna vote for Biden, but then, you know, when they just, I mean, no, I've been to New Hampshire. I've been to New Hampshire every year of the New Hampshire primary for the last, I don't know, way too long a time. They're not exactly thrilled to see you, you know, the people of New Hampshire, you know. The political fans of New Hampshire love it. They line up around the blocks to get into high school gymnasiums to see Barack Obama. And it is quite exciting if you care about that. But you got to understand, you're looking at less than 1% of the population of New Hampshire who ever bother to leave their sofas to go see one of these presidential candidates.
Yeah, it's a good point. Okay, here's my last prediction question. I'm sorry to do this to you.
Can we just deal with all of your anxieties? Because I'm here, as we know, to help you through your anxieties. So that's, we dealt with your New Hampshire anxiety.
Well, I have another one, so we're in good shape.
Okay.
And again, but I don't want to be wrong, that the Dominion court case will go. Do you think that they'll settle, or you think they're going to? I mean, because if it goes, I mean, this is going to be a pretty big blockbuster.
No, so the time to settle has passed. The reason you settle these lawsuits is that you don't want the damage to come out publicly. And so that's why Fox settled every Bill O'Reilly lawsuit. You know, they settle all these things. You settle a lawsuit before Rupert Murdoch has to sit down and testify under oath. They didn't do it. Now, there's what people are neglecting to remember about a settlement is that both sides have to agree to it. So what we do not yet know, and we might someday know, is that Fox made an offer to Dominion and Dominion said no. And if you're Dominion, I personally believe my legal approach to the case, assuming they have $20 million to spend on legal fees, which I guess they do, my approach would be do not settle under any circumstances, because winning the case in court is not important to Dominion's viability as a business. Well, they've already won what they needed to do to be viable as a business. They have proven in all this under oath testimony by Rupert and everybody else exactly the scope and shape of the lies told about Dominion by Fox. So Dominion as a business can go forward in the world, you know, marketing its services anywhere, and no one will ever have to say to them, but wait, you know, Fox said you guys are criminals. Like, that's never right. going to happen, ever. As of today, that's all over. So the important thing is Dominion has won. It has won its reputation, and it has destroyed Fox's reputation. And the only way they could do that is get to this point where we're reading Rupert Murdoch's under oath testimony on TV. And if they had settled, you know, 6 months ago for $100 million or $300 million or $500 million, we would know none of this. And so Dominion has had zero incentive to settle. That's the part people don't understand when they talk about settlement. I'm sure Fox would have loved to settle this a year ago for some number that they thought was reasonable, or even for a number they thought was unreasonable. But the jury verdict is tricky, and it may well be that, you know, Dominion doesn't, quote, win the case in court in the end. And I personally, if I'm on the Dominion end of it, I don't care. I don't right. care. I already won. And if the jury and if the judge, you know, make rulings that say, you know, this stuff lives within First Amendment protections, or if, you know, Fox gets a win like that from the Supreme Court that they sort of own in their way, I don't care. It doesn't change anything about what we know the facts to be. So my strong suspicion about the inside of this is if there was a settlement attempt by Fox, it was refused by Dominion.
Yeah, so interesting. Thank you so much, Lawrence. I hope you'll come back.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step, and you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step, because God, I can't stay where I am, like I am where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how. I don't know where. I don't know what. God, if you show me. God, if you tell me. God, if no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can't fully understand the moment we're living in without knowing where we've been. On every episode of NPR's Throughline, We take a story from the news and go back in time to where it started, where it really started. To answer one important question, how did we get here? Find NPR's Throughline on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
David Folkenflik is a media correspondent at NPR. Welcome to Fast Politics, David.
Thanks, Molly. Glad to join you.
Very thrilled to have you. I just want to talk to you about this continual drip, drip, drip of the Fox News Dominion filing. You have been a media reporter for a while. You've written about the Murdochs. You've written books about the Murdochs. I mean, what is your hot take here?
I wouldn't call it a drip drip so much as a sort of a series of avalanches, you know, in recent days. I think what is notable for somebody who's covered it closely, as I have for coming up on 23 years, you know, the media and Fox has been a big and growing part of that. You know, it's really all part of covering media and politics as well, right? Is how stark it is, how blunt it is, how blatant it is. And the it is the degree to which decisions are made by business imperatives, and those business imperatives are ineluctably entangled in politics. And it's not just, hey, we've got to pander to a right-wing or a left-wing audience. It's, hey, we've got to tamper with what we present to our folks as reality. It's not just that we're Mother Jones and a left of center outfit that does some reporting or the Washington Free Beacon or whatever. It's literally withholding the facts that you know to be true because you know that this is a money gusher and you don't want to turn off the spigot. In fact, the spigot has been drying up a bit, right? After election night 2020 and the original sin of Fox calling Arizona for Joe Biden on that night before any other broadcast network or cable network had done so. Trump voters who had been tuned into Fox to hope that they could celebrate were like, not only celebrating, they're like, oh, screw you. You guys are the guys bringing us this news. You guys are the ones doing this. And for days, other news outlets did not. And you see intimations from people inside Fox saying, well, they're just doing that to hose us by leaving us hanging out there. But they were using different numbers because Fox, joined by the AP, had bailed after the 2016 presidential call was so problematic. That is, the polling data and everything else really just didn't capture what was happening in some of these key swing states. And so Fox kept telling reporters like me, oh, we've come up with better math. We've come up with a better way to do this. And they felt that they had had some success in the off elections of 2018. And then they went all in. Now, that turned out to be a very close call. And in retrospect, one wouldn't have begrudged them not making the call, given how close it turned out to be. It was razor thin. You know, there's an interesting statistical argument to make about whether or not they were taking a little bit of a leap of faith with their new numbers. But they made the call and they trusted their projections. And then you see Fox people, a civil war erupted within Fox as a result of that. So was I surprised? No, so much of this is based on pairing what you see happen on the air with what people from inside Fox are telling you. As a result, I'm not really surprised. It's just so blatant. There's no code words. There's no sleight of hand happening. And, you know, it really only occurred to me in recent days how much of this probably, this incredibly rich documentary record that Dominion is drawing on. We can talk about the merits of the case in a sec, but how much of it's influenced by the fact that it's occurring in the age of COVID. And so people aren't having these conversations in person all that much. They're emailing and texting each other more than they probably would have. Not that they, you know, it's not like Tucker and Sean and Laura are always going out to drinks at night. You know, they can text if they want to text. It's not that I think they particularly like each other, but they have common interests and common grievances. And man, after that election, they are on it. They think that Fox hates them. They think that the news side hates them. They hate the reporters who work for them for pointing out false claims that are made on their shows on Fox and more publicly. It is absolutely civil war happening internally at that network. And it's a sight to behold and to lift up under the rock and see how things behave. And Molly, let's acknowledge that if NPR or the New York Times or CBS or CNN or anybody had all of its, somebody described this as being like an X-ray, you know, this is more like a 3D MRI of all the organs and all the bones and all the muscles, right? Like, this is everything, pretty much. It's really ugly.
Yeah, I think it's kind of shocking. Were you surprised that Tucker hated Trump so much, or that he sent that text message, or no?
I mean, if he was thinking hard, given how often Dominion was sending notes saying this stuff isn't true, he might have thought, well, there might be a lawsuit in my future, and let's keep this, you know, let me not express this. But Tucker, it is very hard not to conclude that Tucker is a pretty cynical person. Does Tucker actually believe there was no violence on January 6th, 2021 at the U.S. Capitol? Does Tucker actually think these were just a pleasant, peaceful protesters ambling perhaps a little too far past a velvet rope that they shouldn't have? The fact that you can find people not committing violence at given moments, of course, a day, does that prove that sworn testimony, videotape, convictions, confessions, all these things that have happened from people who participated in those bloody events, that we will just have that erased from our minds? No, he's providing an hour where he can talk to the audience and tell them what they want to hear. And there's a lot of misdirection. You know, he loathes Trump. So what he does is he goes after Trump's enemies rather than having to go after and defend Trump. It, you know, Fox during the second Bush term in office, the second George W. Bush term, obviously, was kind of depressing to watch. It was not fun. They had to defend things like the war in Iraq, which got increasingly ugly. They had to defend Katrina. They had to defend the collapse of the global. Like, there was a lot to defend, right?
Right.
A lot
right.
more fun going after Obama. And so the thing about Trump was, they kind of would have been happy to have Hillary to go after for another 4 years, right? That would have been fun for them. They could have replayed all the hits of the Clinton years. And instead, they've got to defend Trump. But it turns out Trump is artificially stirring the passions of their audiences to keep watching because nobody knows what he's going to do next. And he keeps calling into Fox and he keeps juicing them. And they just go along for the ride and hold on as best they can. So that's what, you know, Tucker's doing. Tucker's counter-programming. It's a TV thing. And they're letting him do it because they have no control.
Right. He's too valuable. And also at this point, the hosts are running the asylum, right?
I mean, if you're going to go to that analogy, I think, you know, the common wisdom is that in some ways the inmates are running the asylum, that the viewers are, that for a long time Trump kind of was, you know, with his kitchen cabinet of Sean Hannity and Jeanine Pirro and Lou Dobbs, Bartiromo and others, right? Where he's literally pulling people into the administration off Fox from watching them do things. Pete Hegseth was up for, if I'm not mistaken, the Veterans Administration Secretary at one point on the basis of what he says on Fox and Friends.
That's the guy who doesn't wash his hands, right?
That is true. He said that. I mean, credit to his co-host who was like, yeah, that's probably something I don't want to know. But there it was.
I mean, it's such an incredible situation to be in. Do you think that, I mean, who do you, you know, Lou Dobbs is now out, right? And it seemed like he was kind of thrown under the bus there by Rupert, who said he never watches him.
That was kind of great when he said he doesn't watch Fox Business Network, although he called it a channel. You know, it was like, you know, I can't imagine working for that network and feeling very great about that. But, you know, they earned, a lot of them earned decent money to do so. So what are you going to do?
Right.
Dobbs was thrown over when not Dominion Voting Systems, but Smartmatic, an election software company that essentially had almost no involvement in the 2020 elections, filed suit on its own, where Dobbs was out the next day. And Fox is like, well, no, this is all previously scheduled reshuffling and reconstruction. And Dobbs basically was out in his ear. And at the time, it seemed implausible to untrue. And now it just is very clear what occurred. And my experience in covering the Murdoch and various scandals over the years, of which there have been a decent number, they'll throw people over the back of the sled to the wolves at as low a level as possible, but as high a level as needed. And then if that doesn't go, they'll go up the ladder a little bit. And right now, I don't think they're going to do anything because Fox has maintained, and Murdoch said in his speaking under oath to lawyers, that he saw no need to apologize. They were reporting, and this is an integral part of Fox's legal defense, they were reporting inherently newsworthy claims. Hey, the presidential elections were rigged by an inherently newsworthy person. Hey, the sitting president of the United States, and people speaking on his behalf. And that if you were to cut that off, then the Washington Post and MSNBC and everybody else will pay a real price journalistically as well. What, of course, Dominion says, and a lot of media lawyers I talk to say, is there isn't that analogy because what Fox did is so egregious, and because we have not only the clarity, which is legally needed, that key folks knew that what they were putting on the air was untrue and that the people presenting it weren't credible either, but also that they had a motive, which is we have to win back these Trump voters as our viewers. And you don't actually need a motive proven in that way to win defamation in a lot of states, but my goodness, you certainly seem to have one declared. And, you know, there's back and forth. We can talk about the legal merits, but as a supposed news operation, this is a business enterprise talking about the brand promise, and the politics are a key element of it. And the journalism, although Rupert, of all people, occasionally waves the flag in these private correspondences, is not just like a distant third, but like 13th out of three.
So interesting. Do you think that they will go to trial? And also, I have a question for you. This is because it's in Delaware, they can claim more damages, right? In the civil.
My understanding in this case, from following it so far, is that they are applying New York state law in terms of defamation, but they're applying Delaware state law in terms of the administration of the case and the flow of the case. And that gets into some pretty picayune areas. And I am not a member of the bar in either state or any state, and not playing one on TV or on this podcast. But I would say that, you know, the judge hasn't laughed these damages out of court. Fox has made a fairly muscular, or at least rhetorically muscular, argument that the extent of these damages, Dominion Voting Systems is asking for $1.6 billion, but that's sort of a notional figure, that they're clearly inflated in BS. And Dominion is arguing, no, that we have reason to say this. And there's, you know, the question of reputational harm. There's the question of actual harm. And there's the question of punitive damages. So they feel that it all does that. So that's one we'll have to see. But, you know, that's, it's interesting that Fox is stressing all this stuff. It makes sense in the sense that they're saying you have to prove you were hurt. And one way to prove reputational harm is financial harm, right? But that's really an appellate question. That's the kind of thing you're like, well, we lost. Now we've got to fight over how much we actually have to pay. And then you appeal it. This is not uncommon. I don't want to be unfair to Fox. They already have a very strong appellate team in place. That is, the people who will argue the appeals, which says to you that they don't have ironclad confidence they're going to win this thing. But when you have as much money as the Murdochs do, and as Fox Corp does, you know, you hire those people as a routine anyway.
I mean, does Fox eventually say, like, this is too expensive? Or, I mean, Dominion clearly is going for blood, right? There's clearly some ideological, like, you can't ruin us kind of thing. I mean, right?
So Dominion wants to come out of this with a ton of money, and preferably with some sort of prominent retraction and apology. The Murdochs want to come out of this without having to tell their audiences that they were, not only that they were misled, but that they were intentionally misled and deceived and lied to. The Murdochs have shown in previous scandals I've covered, there was the tabloid scandals in Britain, and I sort of stopped counting after they exceeded, I think it was $200 million in various things attached to that. It wasn't that they paid that out as a legal fee for the people they wronged exactly, but those were like a series of costs associated, if I'm remembering it correctly, to that. And it's been a while. They definitely paid more than $200 million in the Fox sexual harassment scandals that largely, but not entirely, focused on Roger Ailes, you know, who they tossed out really the week, basically, that Donald Trump got the Republican National nomination for president in 2016. I was in Cleveland at the RNC intending to write a bunch of stories, and it was all Roger all the time because these allegations came out. It was just, it was the biggest story on the floor, to be honest, beyond Trump. And they paid, you know, many hundreds of millions of dollars, you could argue close to $1 billion, for these various settlements and payoffs that involved this completely unsexy part of what's called News Corp, which is Murdoch's publishing side, and used to be all unified under the same umbrella. I think it was called something like News America, which was basically a supermarket marketing thing that back in the day made a ton of money, where they placed ads and coupons in supermarkets. When you go through the aisles, you could pull off 50 cents here. They have decals on the floor, whatever. And it turned out they did all kinds of things to basically run their competitors into the ground that probably violated the law. And so they paid hundreds of millions of dollars there. So, you know, if Murdoch could cut a check tomorrow and pay $200 million and just make this go away, I imagine that would be a tough but fine deal for them to strike. And I don't think that's what Dominion wants. I think they want to play to a higher pain threshold, both in terms of money and to make him confront what he did. And the less that the Murdochs are willing to acknowledge, the higher dollar figure I would imagine a settlement would take. But so far, you know, what I'm told is that there are no signs of any settlement talks happening, and that, to be honest, I think that's almost entirely on the Dominion side, that the Fox Corp would at least entertain the conversations.
It's so interesting.
Even though they acknowledge doing nothing wrong so far.
Amazing. Too soon to count Newsmax and OAN out.
Define counting them out.
They've been dropped by cable companies. Those two are sort of, you know, they had this moment and it's sort of been now kind of, they've kind of fallen out of favor. I mean, do you think there's a world in which Fox loses those viewers and they go to Newsmax and OAN?
I mean, if you look at this completely stripped of morality, I think the biggest damage Fox could do to its business model is to reveal to its viewers the contempt in which they hold them. That is, they don't respect them. Truth, you can't handle the truth.
Right.
That's their biggest damage. Outside of the question of their ratings, I think they're going to, you know, it's almost like a seesaw where there's an inverse relationship between their reputation outside and the reputation with their audience, where they're going to just take a huge hit with, you know, establishment Washington, mainstream institutions, the news part of Fox, which is really shriveled and withered and lost some of its biggest figures. Shep Smith, Carl Cameron, their longtime guy, walked away saying it was too much for him. Chris Wallace saying that the fever fantasies of January 6th by Tucker Carlson was a step too far for him. You know, these are a thing. You're seeing there are very few figures other than Brett Baier. You know, Eric Shawn, you know, is a reporter and sometime anchor, but, you know, he has a quiet profile there, right? There's a diminishment. They got rid of Chris Steirewalt and Bill Salmon, who were defenders of the decision desk and other things. They've really widowed down the muscle that they have on that side of things. And you can take issue with those guys too, but at least they were there, right? So it seems to me that Newsmax and OAN are unlikely to be major challengers to Fox, unless it somehow breaks that brand promise that Raj Shah and CEO, Fox News CEO Suzanne Scott were so focused on in the documents that have been released, and start backing away from this kind of culture grievance coverage and attending to the needs and the sensibilities and the fears of the Trump voter, even if they're not pro-Trump, which they aren't at the moment. They're really very Ron DeSantis-ish at the moment.
Right.
So that's what I think the real issue is. I also think that their audience, if it fractures, will probably go to things that may not be as conventional TV. You know, right. you can go to whatever the newest Breitbart is. You can go to the Daily Wire. You can go to other people who are going to mainline the stuff into your veins if you want, without the need to have any journalistic sensibilities at all.
Oh, thank you so much, David. That was really depressing.
I do my best. Every little bit I can do to bring you down, Molly, is, you know, look, there are people inside Fox who think, hey, this is going to be a wake-up call. And after we emerge from it, you know, Fox is going to have to revitalize its news coverage and what have you. But at the moment, they're not saying anything like that because they're not able, probably legally or willing from a moral standpoint, to say what we did was wrong. And Dominion, in its latest filings, has made a point of that, to say Fox has basically conceded the point because they haven't done anything to defend an affirmative argument for why any of this stuff had any validity or credibility to it. And that's just a very different way of looking at what Fox did.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks, Molly.
Doug Jones is the former junior senator from the state of Alabama. Welcome to Fast Politics, Senator Doug Jones.
Thank you, Molly. It's great to be with you. I really appreciate the opportunity here.
First, I think we should talk about this weekend in Selma.
Bloody Sunday weekend in Selma is always a very, very special commemoration. And that's the best way to put this. It's a commemoration. They have been doing this. The folks, the organizers down there, have done a wonderful job of having a jubilee every year on the first weekend in March that culminates in a recreation of the walk across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. This year, President Biden came down, gave a fabulous speech at the foot of the bridge. There was a great crowd, enthusiastic crowd. Molly, I think it's so important that we continue those type of recognitions and commemorations because, you know, we have come so far and turned so many pages on the Jim Crow South, but we seem to be flipping some of those pages back right now with voter suppression and so many other laws that discriminate and make it more difficult for minority communities to really get the full benefit of this country. It's so important to remember where we've been so that we try to make sure we don't go there in the future. It's a fabulous weekend.
It's quite a big deal for Biden to come down for that. Can you talk to us a little bit about his thinking?
It is a big deal. It's a big deal for any president. The presidents usually come when it is a signature commemoration, like the 50th or the 45th. The President Obama was there. President Clinton came. When President Obama came, even former President George W. Bush came. But for this president to be there at the 58th, which is not a signature event, but just a commemoration, I think says a lot about him and where his heart is and where he wants to be and wants the country to be. He sees and understands, probably as good as any president we've had, including President Obama, of where things are in this country right now. And that is why he has been appointing so many people of color, particularly women, Black women, to the federal bench. Why his administration is perhaps the most diverse of any administration in history. He sees that the country is becoming more diverse every day, and he is the president of that country, and he wants to celebrate that. But again, he also sees that there are Proud Boys out there, and there are Oath Keepers out there, and there are those who commit mass murders in Buffalo and other places around this country because of hate speech and race. He's got the bully pulpit. He's the leader of this country, and he wants people to understand the significance of what happened, but also the significance of where we are today as a country and where we need to be and going forward as a country. So I think his thinking is that this is, Selma is the time and the place to be right now, probably before he kicks off his presidential campaign, to showcase the country's and his commitment to diversity, to equity, to inclusion.
You have sort of been very central to try to move the South out of, you know, the sort of terrifying
Jim Crow and apartheid. I mean, it's just
exactly
called it like it is. That's what it was.
That's what it was. And that's what it is. And how do you feel right now with America being where it is and also just the sort of larger landscape?
Well, look, you know, you have to qualify everything by saying America is not the Jim Crow days that I grew up in the 50s and 60s. Alabama is not the Jim Crow time. Alabama, the South, the country is not the kind of country where lynchings take place as often as they did a century ago. And we have come such a long way. However, we still have miles to go before we sleep. And I think people should recognize that and see that, because if you look demographically at the country and where things are moving, we are becoming a more diverse country. And we've been becoming a more diverse country, Molly, ever since we were founded. I mean, this country was always meant to be a multicultural, multiracial society, even though some people did not want to accept that. And so we're becoming more diverse from the moment that we declared our independence from Great Britain. As we move forward, though, what we're seeing, so many people fighting these culture wars and playing on the fears of people across this country. And you see groups like the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys, and you see politicians like Donald Trump and others kind of whipping that into a frenzy. And it's not just Trump, by the way. This whole anti-woke movement that you see going on in the MAGA faction of the Republican Party really is troubling. It's really frightening.
Do you think it's really anti-woke, or do you think it's really a kind of bait and switch way of getting back into this sort of racism of the past?
I'm not sure that it's that, except for this. If getting into the racism of the past helps the political future of people who want to run for president, want to run for the Senate, want to run for governors, if that's what it takes, then there are people that will damn sure do that. And that's what's frightening to me. They will take the country backwards for their own political purposes. I don't think that so many of those folks deep down are the racists, not the kind of racist like I grew up with, but they have their own form if they're doing things that perpetuate those racist kind of issues for their own political power. And I've said this for a long time. These are not people who are going to lynch folks, but there were people that dang sure would put folks in the back of the bus if they thought that that would help their political career. And that's what we're seeing. That is what we're seeing across the board. Something happened in Alabama just recently. And this is, I think, typical of where we are in this. I say typical, I don't know if it's typical or not, but we recently had a group of high school students in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, that wanted to have a Black History Month program. And the school administrators said, fine, you can do that. We're happy for you to do that, as long as you don't discuss anything that happened before 1970. I wish I was kidding about it, but I'm not. So these students walked out.
Nothing happened before 1970, so that makes sense.
No, of course not. Everything started when I was 16 years old in 1970. Those students walked out. They relented a little bit, but that's the kind of thing that we're having to face across the country. So I don't think we're in a good place right now, and I think we've got to work through that, and we've got to have some very serious conversations and dialogues about it. Dialogues and not monologues.
Yes, for sure. Quite interesting. So let me ask you now, where do you feel, and you have this long time experience with civil rights and a long time experience with the Biden administration, what do you think the Biden administration should be doing next for voting rights, for civil rights, for the South in general?
You know, I think the administration has done what they could do in terms of using the presidency and the bully pulpit to try to get certain changes to the voting rights bill across the finish line. We couldn't do that for a number of reasons in the last Congress. I think it will be more difficult in this Congress. And by the way, I think the Justice Department and the Civil Rights Division and the folks like that are also taking very careful looks at where we are with voting rights, and they're taking a very serious look at how to protect the rights of people with the laws that we have on the books. I'm hoping that going into 2024, they're also going to do an analysis of the Voting Rights Act and determine that they can also perhaps use the Voting Rights Act to potentially investigate and potentially prosecute people who refuse to certify duly constituted elections. I think the Voting Rights Act, and we've done some research at my law firm on this, I think the Voting Rights Act can be used to make sure that free and fair votes are counted and that they're certified by the appropriate officials. I talked to some folks this weekend down in Selma about that. I think given the dynamics that we have in the Congress right now, I think that the protection of the vote needs to be very strategic. It needs to be more of a rifle shot than a shotgun and not a wish list. It needs to be the things that have, I believe, and I've believed this for some time, the possibility of passing. Right now, for so long, people, Republicans especially, balked at doing anything to establish standards for mail-in voting, for early voting, that every state should be required to have some form of minimum standards and require the states to do something on early votes and mail-in votes. Well, all of a sudden, after the last election, many Republicans were saying, maybe this early voting's not so bad, because they were losing elections because their folks weren't utilizing what they had in these states. Well, let's take this opportunity to say, great, why don't you join us and let's establish these minimum standards. Instead of having a hodgepodge of laws across 50 states, let's require all states to do some form of early voting, some form of mail-in voting, and have uniform standards that can be enforced across the states. And as part of that, Molly, and a lot of people, I know a lot of your listeners probably don't want to hear this, but as part of that, you're going to probably have to also do some form of national voter ID. But the key to that, in my opinion, has always been being able to require folks to be able to get those voters and the states to provide those voters, not just have one van like they've got in Alabama that you can call for and go to, but really make an effort to get voter IDs out there that the state will do and give a broad range of state IDs that can be done. I think if we can be really strategic, that's what I would like to see the administration and my friends in the Senate and the House do. And let's get something passed to protect the right to vote. Because at the end of the day, there are still states and we still have trouble getting people to the polls.
Wow. You really think a voter ID is the way to go on that?
I think it has to be in order to get something passed. I think you've got to do something to get this passed.
To give the Republicans.
Exactly. Everything about our democracy right now is a divided government. A form of national voter ID was part of the Freedom to Vote Act. And I know a lot of the civil rights group and a lot of my friends didn't particularly like that. They kind of bit their tongue. But it was there. It was necessary to even have that bill to have a chance. I think we're going to have to look at that. And quite frankly, if you couple that with resources and requirements that would require the states to be able to get those voter IDs out there, to people. The biggest issue, in my view, Molly, what I've seen, the biggest issue is not the ID itself. It's getting the ID. And that's a real problem. In Alabama, you know, when we passed that voter ID, the photo ID thing, first thing that a former governor did was shut down some of the DMVs in our Black Belt area. And they had Justice Department had to come in and sue them to get those things opened back up. It's access to the ID. And if we can get resources and requirements that would require the state to get those voter IDs out there, then the ID itself would be so much less of a problem.
Right, I guess. I mean, I don't know. I feel like voter ID is just a way to make it harder to vote.
People have said that, and I agree with that. But if you've got access to an ID, it is not hard to pull it out at a poll. The problem that we've got with voter ID is not the ID itself, in my view, except for access to it. Access to photo IDs is a problem, and I agree with that. That's why you've got to give folks some resources. In Alabama, for instance, now, in order to vote absentee, you have to make a photocopy of your photo ID to mail in with your absentee ballot application. Now, not everybody in Alabama's got a damn printer, okay? And they're not going to go down the street to the local Kinko's or whatever the thing and make a copy of that. It's the barriers that keep being put up around those photo IDs that are a huge problem, and access barriers of getting the photo IDs and the kind of photo IDs. In Alabama, you can, high school students that are state schools can't use their high school issued student ID card for some reason. I don't know why. It's a state ID. It's a state school. They can't use that. If we expand what is out there and the ability of states and require states to provide those upon request, then I think that the voter ID issue would not be as big of concern as it seems to be. And it is a concern. Make no mistake. I don't want anybody out there to think that I'm not concerned about the voter ID issues. I think there's ways to solve it. And if we can work with people, I think we can solve that particular issue and give access to more people and get them out to the polls.
Very interesting, Doug Jones. I sort of disagree with you about the voter ID, but I understand where you're coming from. I also just don't think of Republicans as being good faith negotiators.
Well, that is a problem these days. I think there is some problem on both sides of the aisle with that, but particularly when it comes to voting rights, I think that is especially true with folks on the other side of the aisle. Senator McConnell has made it very clear he does not want to see any kind of voting rights legislation, whether it's the John Lewis Voting Rights Act or any others, the Freedom to Vote Act. He's made that very clear. So there's got to be an element of good faith. That doesn't mean we don't try. I think we've got to try, and I think we've got to continue to talk about it and have people like you and I talk about it.
I just am curious, like, there's a lot of stuff that Biden could just do unilaterally. Do you think he should do more of that, like through executive order?
And I'm not sure what he can do unilaterally about voting right now. I mean, we've got the Voting Rights Act, and I think the Justice Department is there, but they're in lawsuits all over the place.
Right.
They've got, you know, the Alabama Voting Rights Act case that's pending right now that I'm very worried about because we've got a Supreme Court that does not seem to like the Voting Rights Act. So I think that the president's hands are somewhat tied when it comes to voting, since historically the federal government has ceded most of that authority to the states, and it is only through the Voting Rights Act, and there may be some others. I'm not a complete legal scholar, even though I'm a lawyer, that there may be some potential things that they can do, but I think it's limited as to what the president can do himself, and that's why he has done as much as he could do at every opportunity to use the bully pulpit of the presidency and get people engaged, because this is a state issue, unfortunately. I think it needs to be a little bit more of a federal issue because we've got federal elections every 2 years. And by the way, you know, there's a lot of misinformation out there that you would think, listening to people, that the Constitution gives the states the sole right to manage elections. That's not the case. It does give states the right to do that, but then there's a qualifier to it that says that the Congress of the United States can step in and modify those and take some control. That's what the Voting Rights Act of 1965 did.
Doug Jones, thank you so much, Senator. I hope you'll join us again.
Would love to do it sometime, Molly. Thanks so much for having me. It's great to talk to you.
And now your moment of fuckery. Molly Jungfest.
Jesse Cannon.
Oh, anytime you have to see Matt Taibbi in a public forum these days, it's just so depressing. It goes so bad.
I think that Elon should have to buy him a horse after that performance. I'm just telling you, like, I understand that Taibbi thought this was going to do something for him, but it's really embarrassing. It would take a lot to get me up in one of those hearings for a political party, but it would take a really a lot to get me up at those hearings for someone as dumb as jacketless Jim Jordan.
Imagine with the way Jim Jordan's been leading these things, going, I think it's a good idea for me to show up today and not fake scurvy or something.
Well, you know, these are all optional. I mean, these aren't even subpoena. Yeah. I mean, these are like, you know, you have the honor of testifying. I mean, I don't know what to say about Matt Taibbi. He's clearly, I don't know. You know, it's really depressing to see someone like this who has done some good work.
Amazing journalism for decades before this.
Right. Turn into a complete whatever that is, but
a sycophant to a billionaire's bidding.
He is our moment of fuckery today, and I think it's pretty well deserved. That's it for this episode of Fast Politics. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to hear the best minds in politics make sense of all this chaos. If you enjoyed what you've heard, please send it to a friend and keep the conversation going. And again, thanks for listening.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can't fully understand the moment we're living in without knowing where we've been. On every episode of NPR's Throughline, we take a story from the news and go back in time to where it started, where it really started. To answer one important question, how did we get here? Find NPR's Throughline on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.